So, does Bill Gates have a point in a bombshell statement last week? The Microsoft founder come billionaire philanthropist, arguing that environmentalists devote too much effort to the planet's warming temperatures and not enough to helping humans adapt to the new normal. Gates turning up the heat on delegates traveling to the COP30, the annual UN climate summit this year in the Brazilian Amazon city of Belém. We'll review the argument that the transition to cleaner energies is already bearing fruits, rendering 2015 Paris Agreement projections out of date, or with coal and oil production still rising, whether it's too soon to take the foot off the gas of green investment. In an age of echo chambers and slashed public spending, the far right seizing on Gates' remarks as proof, they say, that climate change is a hoax. This, as many European conservatives push to roll back environmental norms, this in the name of slashing red tape and competitiveness. So, as insurance companies count the cost of rising sea levels, fiercer storms, and deadlier fires, how best to invest in humanity's common future? Today in the France 24 debate, is Bill Gates right about climate change priorities? With us from Rio de Janeiro, where she's attending the World Mayors Summit that precedes COP30, Hélène Chartier, Director of Urban Planning and Design at the advocacy group of that brings together municipalities from around the globe, C40 Cities. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
From Brussels, French member of the European Parliament, Thomas Pellerin-Carlin of the centre-left Place Publique Party. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
She's an economist specializing in environmental policy, Cristina Peñasco, researcher at Sciences Po's Laboratory for Interdisciplinary Evaluation of Public Policies. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And we welcome back energy and transport analyst and consultant Nicolas Mélan. Good to see you.
Hi, good evening, François.
A reminder, if you're on the go, you can listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. It's time to put human welfare at the center of our climate strategies. That's the clarion call posted to Bill Gates' website. Although climate change will have serious consequences particularly for people in the poorest countries, it will not lead to humanity's demise, he argues. Gates arguing, thanks to a chart that you see here, that innovation has cut projected future emissions by 40% in the 10 years since the Paris agreements. And after Washington's gutting of international funding for the developing world, the Microsoft co-founder sounding the alarm over the Gates Foundation's original remit, which is vaccines and alleviating poverty. Gavi, the vaccine buying fund, will have 25% less money for the next 5 years compared to the past 5 years. We have to think rigorously and numerically about how to put the time and money we do have to the best use. Hélène Chartier, your reaction to this manifesto to pivot our thinking when it comes to climate change and global warming.
Yeah, I think a few years ago, everyone was talking only about emission reduction. And in some way, we needed to bring climate adaptation, so how to prepare our cities and our country to be ready for the increasing of climate risk. But I think now we are seeing a bit the opposite happening. And I think it's we need to find the right balance. We should not oppose emission reduction and urban adaptation because both are essential and they are in some way two sides of the same fight. If we limit GHG emission, we can also limit the severity of the climate events. And also it's important because scientists are warning us about the risk of a tipping point, which could really trigger a form of chain reaction of climate events. For example, heat and drought leading to wildfire, which turn in increasing emission. So it's very important to bring the two legs of the climate change, reducing emission and preparing our cities and country to the increasing climate risk together. And I would say just one more thing. It's also a matter of solidarity and equity, I would say, because it's clear that Global North countries produce far more emissions per capita, while the residents from Global South will be the first and the hardest to be hit by a climate impact. So Global North countries like France and others have also responsibility to try to reduce their emission in order to limit the scale of the climate crisis for them, for the people in the Global South, but also for ourselves. So I would think it was right to equilibrate, to find the balance in the debate, but we need the two to keep the two elements together.
Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, in fairness to Bill Gates, he does not say to stop trying to fight global warming. What he simply says, as you saw in that little excerpt we showed, is that there's really not enough money to go around. You have to pick priorities at this point in time because of dwindling public funding. And the priority should be on human welfare, as he puts it. Do you agree with Hélène Chartier that the pendulum swings a little too far with this statement that he put out?
I mean, it's really a matter of interpretation, but in truth, the only way for us to act in a way that will allow humankind to survive the 21st century is to work both on climate change mitigation, so that means cleaner energy, electric cars, etc., and also on climate change adaptation, because there is a part of climate change that is already irreversible. And the objective, why we are doing this, is to make sure that we can live happy lives, both as individual and as collective, as a civilization, throughout the 21st century and hopefully the one after that. So we need to do both. Then the question is how we can put human welfare at the center of climate policy. That's what we are fighting for here in the European Parliament. Let me give you just one example. We're fighting for the European Social Leasing Scheme. And the idea is very simple. It's to allow rural Europeans that have a low income to have access to an electric car, and they just need to pay a small rent, a monthly fee of 80 to 150 euros per month. So they can have access to the small electric car that will improve their human welfare while also acting for climate and for the European automotive industry.
Nicolas Mélan, is there enough money to do both, to climate mitigation and adaptation to the new normal?
Well, if you look at what was done a couple of years ago by a Nobel Prize, I think Mr. Stern, he evaluated the money that we needed for the transition to be $1,500 billion per year. That's what was supposed to be, you know, the transfer from the rich country to the poor countries for clean energy adaptation. But what did we get out of this 1,500 billion euro on eventually every year? I think the number is 10. So it's obviously not happening, this financing.
Okay,
so there's
not enough money.
The money is not there.
So where's the priority?
Well, the priority is, you know, I think we're getting to the 30th Conference of Parties. You know, we started back in 1995. And it is the 30th almost year in a row that emissions are still increasing. So I think we are missing a piece of the puzzle. And this piece of the puzzle is very easy. It's the fact that China joined World Trade Organization back in 2001, and rich countries outsource their production back to China made out of coal. So we basically live in a world made out of coal, which is about one sort of emission. And the only reason why emission is not decreasing is because emission in China up to now have been increasing. So let's take example of France. France, we consume a lot of coal, not in the central plant because we have nuclear, but in our importations. More than 50% of our carbon footprint is our imports, and we do nothing about it.
Stuff that's made with heavy industry.
Of course.
Cristina Peñasco, what was your reaction when you read Bill Gates's statement there?
I was very surprised, given that he wrote a book in 2021 calling about the climate change disaster. And it's true that he doesn't mention this idea of a hoax, but somehow he's putting priorities and ranking things that cannot be ranked. He's opposing the view of facing or fighting poverty, fighting health issues with climate, while they are intricately connected. There is an endogeneity issue in this story of him. You cannot fight poverty without taking care of the climate, and you cannot fight climate change without adapting certain areas of the planet, above all in poor.
So regions. Why did he pivot between 2021 and today?
That's a very good question. I think he's not wrong in thinking of putting welfare at the center of the issue, but the narrative is certainly pernicious, I would say.
Pernicious?
Pernicious. I think it's not the right narrative to face these two issues. And it's what actual evidence is telling us. Scientific evidence is telling us that if we increase 0.1 degrees, he used this idea of increasing 0.1 degrees centigrade versus eradicating malaria. It's like, well, you cannot oppose these issues because they are connected. You increase temperature, you will have more cases of extreme weather events, and therefore you will have more cases of particular diseases, vector-borne transmitted diseases, like malaria, for example. So I don't know if there are other interests behind his statements, but certainly the narrative has changed.
Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, are there other interests behind Bill Gates' statement?
I don't think there are other interests behind Bill Gates' statement, but there are clearly a lot of interests that are fighting against climate action. I mean, if you make money by drilling oil and gas, which is the business model of Vladimir Putin and a lot of private and public companies all over the world, the oil drillers, the gas drillers, obviously they don't want climate action. They would be happy to see the world burn as long as they can have higher quarterly profits. So there are very, very strong interests, and we feel them here in this European Parliament, where we see the falsehood, the lies, that a company like ExxonMobil, which is a foreign company, is spreading around the here in the European Parliament. But more broadly, ExxonMobil has been funding fake science and fake news for decades on climate. And this is well documented even by the scientific community now. So obviously, when you want to act for climate, you make a lot of winners, but also there are people that are losing. The problem that we have is the people that are winning are not really potent today. The biggest winners of climate action are our kids. And our kids do not vote currently because they don't have the age to vote. And they are losers, and the losers tend to be all white men with ties. And they tend to be billionaires, and they tend to be ruling countries like Russia.
Gates' post, by the way, drawing a reaction from another fan of the pivot, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, saying, we just won the war on the climate change hoax. Bill Gates has finally admitted he was completely wrong capitalized, on the issue. Of course, that's not exactly what Bill Gates puts it, wrote down. Nonetheless, let me ask you, Hélène Chartier, you're at this conference of mayors. Currently, you're association co-chaired by the mayor of London, who's also crossed fences with Donald Trump, as well as the mayor of Freetown, Sierra Leone. But let me ask you, what's the view right now on the timing of this statement at this moment in time from Bill Gates?
I think we should make a difference between what Bill Gates say and what Trump is saying. I think Trump is also using what Bill Gates is saying. I don't think at all, even if I disagree with what Bill Gates say, and I definitely think we need to both reduce the severity of climate change by continuing to reduce GHG emission and at the same time adapt, I don't think he said at all that climate change was a hoax. And I think if you hear what President Trump say earlier this year during the UN General Assembly, he was just mentioning that climate change is a hoax. And I think the day after, you have a lot of national president like the President Lula and cities coming together to say, this is not okay. This is disinformation. We need to push back and everything. So I think Trump is also trying to use what Bill Gates is saying. Bill Gates is going too far. I don't think we should pivot so far in the fact only focusing on climate adaptation. We need definitely the both action. But I think we can definitely see how Trump is trying to use this to continue his fight of disinformation and trying to kill all of the local leaders, the national government, who try to continue to fight against the accelerating climate change.
In 2017, Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the Paris agreements. The COP summits went on, despite the U.S. eventually rejoined. At the time, there were workarounds. Now, though, his administration is actively punishing those that try to curb global carbon emissions. There was a recent meeting of the International Maritime Organization. It was billed as historic because for the first time they were going to agree on a carbon tax for shipping. But the Financial Times this weekend, quoting five sources who attended, who explained how the U.S. delegation basically torpedoed the plan using bully boy tactics. One of those delegates saying they went from delegation to delegation, threatening them, telling them to go back to speak to their capitals, warning what would happen if they didn't change their minds. The article, Nicolas Mélenchon, also says that they warned some of the African and Caribbean delegates that they and their families wouldn't get visas if they voted in favor of this measure. You're complaining about China, but the United States is acting a little differently than it did the first time Donald Trump.
Yeah, but there is something interesting that I like to explain here. Donald Trump obviously is seeing that climate change is a hoax, and he's been reducing, for example, tax credit for electric cars. But in what he does, it's slightly different, because when he was first in office, he replaced coal in electricity generation by gas, and that reduced a lot of CO2 emission from the U.S. And now, what he is doing now with his import tax, 34% on China, and maybe 100%
on top of this. He's pulling EV subsidies in the United States.
Yeah, but this tax on countries such as China, such as India, those very polluting countries using a lot of coal, this could be a way to actually reduce CO2 emission globally. What are we doing in Europe? Do you know which free trade agreement we are discussing with? We are now discussing with India, top second country using coal in the world, and with Indonesia, number three. So we are actually doing the other way around. So at the end of the story, there is what people say, and that is what people do. But I'm suspecting, and we'll have to follow this, looking at China's export to the U.S. China economy is going to contract with what happened in the U.S. And that could be a very good news for the climate and for its emission.
Do you agree with that, Cristina Peñasco?
I have the feeling that China is doing a lot in terms of investments, even if obviously terms of coal,
well,
they are doing
well.
A lot. In reality, they are putting a lot of money in renewable energy, in clean energy, and investments that are very important for the transition.
But they still have 60% of electricity from coal.
Absolutely. I don't deny that. But in the case of the U.S., I think it's slightly different as what you were saying before about the fact that the U.S. has left the COP framework and so on and so forth. Sometimes it's better that they are out of the table, because otherwise they are going to oppose this particular type of policies or the agreements that they have reached before. And if they are not on the table, we will be able to act, take it all as well into consideration that in the U.S., for example, all the there are many policies, the environmental policies, green policies, if we call it that way, that take place at the state level and not at the federal level. So this framework is not being that much affected by Trump policies per se. So it's not a bad thing in one way if they are going to oppose that they don't see it on the table.
All right, so we looked at the reaction of Donald Trump. Let's look at another reaction, that of Jeffrey Sachs. He's a known scientist, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at New York's Columbia University. He called Bill Gates's memo pointlessly vague, unhelpful, and confusing. There is no reason to pit poverty reduction versus climate transformation. Both are utterly feasible and readily so if the big oil lobby is brought under control. Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, we're trying to figure out the timing of all of this. Again, just ahead of COP30. Your thoughts?
I mean, first let me say one word about Donald J. Trump. We're talking about the guy that was providing medical advice to people during COVID, saying that you can cure COVID by drinking bleach. That is Donald J. Trump. So let's maybe, you know, not pay too much attention to the pseudo-scientific advice he's giving us. His energy policy is controlled by the oil lobby. His entire energy policy is economically insane. Trump has been canceling offshore wind projects that were already financed, already built under construction. The impact of that is the destruction of American jobs. The impact of that canceling is also that there will be less electricity in the USA. And the USA is already suffering from blackouts because they have, pardon my French, but a very shitty electricity grid. So we need to stay focused on the ball. What is the cheapest source of electricity in the world today? It depends on the places in the world, but it's always either solar or wind power or hydropower. And those are three key renewable electricity sources. We've made a lot of progress over the last 10 and 20 years. A lot of that has to do about innovation, and that Bill Gates' point is clear on that and is right. But innovation is not something that falls from the sky. It is the creation of human efforts. It is engineers and workers and entrepreneurs and investors that are putting time and money in order to improve the way we produce, the way we transport, the way we consume energy. And that is absolutely critical that we continue to have the policy framework that supports that kind of innovation to happen so we can live better lives. There would be slightly different lives, but they would be improved as a result of the policies that we do. And that, has, of course, has to do with cleaner energy, but also on how we can adapt our way of life to an already warmer planet. And let me maybe just say one last thing, building on what Jeffrey Sachs is saying. There is no way we solve poverty in the world if we fail on climate change. If we fail on climate change, there will be no way to feed the global population. Full stop. And the poor people will be the first one to starve to death.
Yeah, but it's a question of limited resources for public finances. It's where do you put, if you don't have enough money to do both the research for innovation that you describe and helping people prepare for this new normal, then where's the priority?
Okay, two things here. First, we're spending a lot of money now. We're spending a lot of money buying oil and gas. We Europeans, we spend 1 billion euro per day to buy foreign, Iranian, Trump, and Russian oil and gas. So the money is there. The fossil fuel system is extremely expensive. And the people that pay the price are the kids that die as a result of air pollution. It's the farmers from even my own region of Normandy that are fighting drought in Normandy and that worry about whether they will be able to produce cattle and milk, even in a place like Vire in Calvados, where I'm from. So those are the people that are paying the price of the very expensive price of the fossil fuel system. And on adaptation, I mean, I'm sorry, we don't need more money for adaptation. We need common sense, which adaptation is not about spending more money to build more dams. It is first and foremost about including the climate impacts that we already know are happening and will worsen in the future in everything that we do from an infrastructure perspective. Maybe we need a few millions here and there for research on adaptation. Actually, we do need that. Satellite and early warning system and supporting firefighters, absolutely. But for adaptation, it's really about making a smart investment. Investing in the world as it will be in the future, not the world that some crazy US president thinks we're going to have.
And again, there are workarounds even in the United States. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce put out a study in collaboration with private insurance provider Allstate, which finds that for every dollar invested in disaster preparedness, the United States could save $33. That's according to that one study. So let me ask you, Hélène Chartier, what's on the agenda at the mayor's conference you're attending and at COP30? What's the priority?
I think today, I mean, we have 2 days where it's really mayors and local governments who are coming together and discussing, I would say, both, how they could accelerate their climate adaptation agenda. So we are discussing how we are accelerating retrofit building. And actually, for example, retrofitting building is a very good way to do both. You reduce your energy bill, but you also reduce the overheat in your flat or in your house. So there is also a way to bring the two actions together. So they discuss how they change the way they plan and design city, how we, for example, in the Global South, trying to limit the expansion of cities in places that are very dangerous in terms of flooding or landslide. And that's, for example, if you took what happened in Valencia, you were mentioning before, it's not in Global South, but we know that the way we have been expanding cities didn't take at all into account the reality of the flooding risk in the city. So we need to help city to better understand what's going to happen, to bring back nature in city. We know that green space, permeable soil is the best way for city today to reduce flooding, to also bring back freshness in city. So there is a lot of things to discuss to accelerate the adaptation of cities, but also at the same time to reduce emission, car dependency in city, to also reduce the energy bill of the citizen. So I think there is a plenty of discussion happening, a lot of commitment of Mayer also. It's not just about exchanging ideas. They also commit, and it's very important, it's not the nation who's commit. A lot of cities today, for example, have committed on their cool plan, how to reduce urban heat in their cities. They have been also discussing on how they adapt the way they are developing their master plan, planning policy to embed climate adaptation and climate mitigation in their master plan, in their rules of construction, to also discuss about flood and food plan, for example, of the city to reduce the consumption-based emission of their citizens. So there is plenty of discussion and commitment of Mayors just ahead of the national negotiation that will take place in Belém in next week.
And we saw it with Hurricane Melissa swinging through the Caribbean, which cities had better or worse structures to prepare for such an intense and fierce Category 5 storm. We're talking about Sevilla. As wildfires raged in Spain this summer, the city saw the mercury climb to 48 degrees last June. But what's high on everyone's mind, especially this Monday, is last year's flood, a flood that's the biggest in decades. Last week, the king led a state funeral honoring the victims of the catastrophe, more than 200 of them. The regional president came under copious boos at one point. Carlos Mazón, who this Monday tendered his resignation while at the same time shifting the blame slightly. Let's listen.
I can assure you that, if it were up to me, I would have resigned a long time ago. There have been unbearable moments for me, but above all for my family. I truly believed it would be easier to show from this position what happened during the emergency response, the information we didn't have, the aid that never arrived, and above all, that I could help rebuild this land after the devastation. But I can't go on.
Cristina Peñasco, your reaction there, listening to the now former president of the Valencia region.
I just see a lack of political responsibility on his statements. I mean, he's resigning 1 year later. Well, she had to have resigned. Well, at the moment, he didn't attend his duties as president of the Valencian community. There were a lot of issues. He's fine in saying that there was lack of aid flowing and so on and so forth, but there was a first alarm that arrived late and he was not in the meeting he had to be. So I think he should have taken responsibility and accountability of this way before. And I mean, better late than never, but in reality, I think...
What's the lesson of Valencia for Europe and for the world?
That these events are happening way more frequently than before, and way more strongly than before. Something that Hélène has mentioned as well. During the real estate boom in Spain, we were constructing a lot of buildings in places in which we shouldn't have constructed buildings. This is something that we have to learn from in the urban planning that we are doing for the future as well. And maybe integrate as well the idea or how to communicate to the average citizen the risks and the uncertainties of this particular type of events and what are the consequences. Maybe through participatory democracy or participatory budget, there is a way as well to create more awareness of this type of issues and what are the consequences.
Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, you heard both Cristina Peñasco and Hélène Chartier allude to the call by some in the face of heavier rains for more protection of wetlands, places where the water can go in case there's heavier than expected storms. What's being done at the European level? What should be done?
So we are currently working with my colleague from Malta, Tomas Bayada, on the water resilience strategy. And that is to do with that we have a policy that allows both to avoid the negative impacts of drought, which are critical for our economy, especially for our agriculture. And at the same time, we also avoid the devastating impacts of flooding. Because in a way, climate change is a disruption of the natural cycle of water. And climate change means that we will have more severe drought and more severe floods at the same time. And if you just want to test that, you can test that actually at home. If you've got a dry sponge and you put water on top, the sponge does not drink the water. And that's what we see happening. So we need to have a comprehensive policy there. And I hope our colleagues from the center-right, from the Christian Democrats, will agree to work with us and not with the far-right on our agricultural policy. Because that's one policy area where the European Union is massively big and where it is putting a lot of money on the table already. We need to make sure that this favors the type of agriculture we need in order to have a resilient system so we can avoid drought and floods. And at the end of the day, we can do what politics is all about, which is improving people's life and making sure that people can first live and second, obviously, live happily.
Except right now in Europe, with or without Donald Trump, leaders are talking about too much red tape. The latest EU summit 10 days ago, the likes of France's president, Italy's prime minister, Germany's chancellor, urging a lighter touch on environmental norms.
None of us question the goal of protecting the climate. We all agree that we must combine this with the competitiveness of the European industry. This involves technology and its development across Europe. We must keep pace and watch what is happening across the world.
Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, it doesn't sound like the Christian Democrat Chancellor of Germany is on your side when it comes to wetlands.
I mean, we need to be clear. So we had a vote recently on a new EU regulation that will be adding red tape by banning marketing practices from private companies that want to sell lentils and other type of vegetarian protein, labeling that as a veggie burger, for instance. And so therefore, when I hear people that they say they want to cut red tape, I just want to check what they voted on that. And they voted like the majority of the centre-right, but not only, and the entirety of the far-right voted in favour of that amendment in the European Parliament. And therefore, they created red tape while making actually the transition towards vegetable protein harder for many, many people in Europe and destroying economic activity from farmers that are growing cereals and lentils and need to have a market for this. So we need to be clear, like this is an excuse. Obviously, I'm in favor of simplicity. Like, who is against simplicity? Let's be clear. But let's not kid ourselves. This is a rhetorical argument that is not backed by any strong political will. The one thing that I expect from the Chancellor of Germany to do is to say that we need a bigger European budget so we can face all the challenges that Europe is facing. Obviously, number one is defense, given the Russian war on European civilization that is currently happening, but also climate. And those two things are related, because the most peaceful way for us Europeans to defeat Russia, to defeat Vladimir Putin, is to make sure that we do the global clean energy transformation, because a world without oil and gas is not only a world where we can have peace through climate action and climate protection, it's also a world where we can achieve peace in Europe through the weakening of the Russian economy.
Nicolas Mélan?
Yeah, I mean, norms is usually a good thing. It's a good way to protect yourself. That's why we had the most protective automotive industry, because we had norms, crash norms, environment norms. But the problem is in Europe is we are the only one to respect the norms. And we should impose those norms on our importers.
So this is an important question. You talk about the automotive industry. There's this objective for Europe by the year 2030.
2035.
Yeah. Excuse me, you're correct. To switch away from combustion engines to either hybrids or electric vehicles. Yeah. Is the EU going to roll that back?
Well, in the meantime, they have this objective to get rid of ICE, which is probably a good thing because we don't have oil in Europe. But on the same side, there is a norm in Europe that encourages manufacturers to produce big cars. I call them electric tank. And not all the Europeans are going to be able to buy electric tanks. They're going to be able to buy Chinese cheap cars. So the problem with this target for the time being is with no protection from
China. Should it be rolled back?
Well, it should be... maybe add some other, we should make sure that by then we don't buy all the cars from China made out of coal, basically.
Cristina Peñasco, the way things are going right now in Brussels, in European capitals, do you see the EU sticking to that climate target when you saw those leaders saying, look, let's pause a little bit on the Green Deal here?
I think we should take into consideration in this particular case what the public perceives as well. So rolling back on green or thinking about a green backlash, something like that, it doesn't make sense for Europe in this very moment. And I think this idea as well of counter or opposing views of competitiveness and the green transition is a fallacy, because it can go hand in hand. It's true, as Nicolas mentioned before, that we are having a lot of rules that we need to pay for, but in reality, this can bring competitiveness to Europe, and people, the general citizenship, should understand this or might want to understand this. And this is a way to go on to move forward in particular, and I don't think European cities or countries are going to stop the transition. I think the process is going on. We need to think forward. We need to invest in infrastructure and just bring the idea of distributional issues, which is one of the problems that we are facing with the general public, on top of the agenda as well. So there is not this green backlash in terms of policies.
And then Chartier, regarding this green backlash, do you feel as though you're playing defense? I realize that the mayor's conference represents urban areas, which are very specific. Obviously, a lot of constituents in those cities don't even own cars. But do you feel as though you're playing defense right now?
I think cities are acting very fast. We have seen that, for example, cities who are part of the C40 network today, they are reducing their emission three times faster than their nation. So there is, the day after Trump, during his first mandate, left the Paris Agreement, the mayors of most of American cities say they will stay in the Paris Agreement and will continue to accelerate. I think there is an opportunity for cities to continue to advance on their climate agenda and to do that in a way that is in some way business friendly. What they want business is to be aware, to have a vision, to understand what is the pathway. They want a form of stability. We have seen a lot of cities and countries, I'm thinking, for example, of the Nordic cities, where they have been defined a very clear path. And so the industry is very ready. And in some ways, it can be a chance for them because they prepare their industry and they become a form of global leaders on sustainability. So we see a lot of industry also in China. China see what's happening in some way in the U.S. as an opportunity for them to accelerate a very green industry and to become the leader on this. So I think it's important to have norm, and I think mayors want to continue to regulate the construction. We need to reduce the use of steel. Mm. We need to reduce the use of cement to reduce energy. We need to bring more nature, permeable space in urban development. All of these mean policies. But I think it's possible, and the industry is on board as soon as they are prepared and there is a form of pathway for them so they can be ready and contribute to this transformation. So we need a form of collaboration between the private sector and the city to accelerate the green transition.
All right, so that's at the municipal level. Thomas Pellerin-Carlin, there's going to be municipal elections in France coming up next March. There are a lot of green-run cities. They may or may not do well, the green mayors, with all of the issues that have just been spelled out there by Hélène Chartier. But at the national level, the Greens and those that are environmentalists are on the back foot. We saw it no later than last Wednesday. They underperformed in the Dutch elections. Why are the Greens not doing as well as they were a few years back?
I think we should not assume that the Green voters are voting only for the Green Party. I can tell you that from my personal experience. I mean, I was a researcher for a decade. I became a politician a year and a half ago, and I was running on the Social Democratic ticket led by Raphael Glucksmann for the European elections in France. And we did very well. And one of the reasons why we did very well is because we had a green policy agenda that was obviously linked to our sovereignty as French and as Europeans vis-à-vis foreign powers like Russia, that was obviously also linked to the social justice agenda that has been the core agenda of the social democracy in Europe for more than a century. century now.
So you don't think that environmentalists currently you don't think environmentalists currently
realism,
you don't think that environmentalists currently are on the back foot
people in France to vote for our list and to create what arguably was a big electoral surprise in France, and we forgot about it because of the snap election, but that is what happened. So assuming that the green vote goes only to the green parties, really looking at this from a very, very narrow lens, I can tell you of many members of the green parliament, from the centrists, from the social democrats, but also from the EPP, from the Christian democrats, that are really green when it comes to the public policy. Coming back on the Dutch elections, there were two parties from the center-right, CDA and BBB. CDA is a pro-climate party. They performed exceptionally well in the Netherlands in the Dutch election. They came close second. The BBB was a party formed recently against the Green Deal. They are also in the EPP, in the centre-right political family, and they did very badly. And to me, that is the example that if you want to be a pragmatic politician today, regardless of whether you're left-wing or centre-right, you need to have green policies. Otherwise, the young people and everybody who cares about the future of their kids will simply not take you seriously, and for good reasons.
Cristina Peñasco, what's your feeling right now as we head towards the end of 2025 when it comes to political ecology, as we call it here in France?
So the fears of the polls are speaking. In reality, with your question about, in particular, green parties are losing ground. Even if there are people that are voting or with green interests that are voting for other parties, there is a reality they are losing ground. In my opinion, and I think what evidence says, is like there are two issues here. People are changing preferences, and it's not a matter of not worrying about the environment or not worrying about climate change, but it's about other issues related to inflation, other issues related to the war in Ukraine, to defense, to the cost of life, and so on and so forth, that might be impacting the voting for green parties that are perceived to focus exclusively on environmental issues. And maybe that's the reason why, as Thomas mentioned, there is rerouting of the green voting towards other type of parties. The second one is more related to citizens' perceptions of the programs of these green parties, which is related to what I just mentioned. So it's not a matter of I don't concern or I don't worry about the environment. It's about which policies are being put in place and how they are affecting me personally in my daily life. And this global, or the average citizen, is actually perceiving these policies are not favoring them. I mean, we have the experience here in France with a Gilets Jaunes.
Yeah, the Yellow Vest, which started with a carbon tax protest.
Exactly. So there is this kind of dichotomy, and what we are seeing is actually still people concerned about the environment. There is an increase, if we use data, for example, from OPSCOP survey, we are seeing that there is an increase in concern about the environment, but there is a decrease with time in relation to support for climate policies. And it's related to the sense of fatigue to certain segments of the population that are not seeing that these policies are putting their interest at the center or at the core of the outcomes that they should have. And that's why what I mentioned before, it's very important to take into consideration this distributional aspect of particular policies. Thomas mentioned as well that there will be winners and losers, and we have to find a way to compensate these losers. And maybe the citizenship is not seen in green parties this particular type of objective.
Cristina Peñasco, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well Nicolas Mélan, Hélène Chartier, for joining us from the Mayor's Summit that precedes COP30 in Brazil, and Thomas Pellerin-Carlin for being with us from the European Parliament in Brussels. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.